the one that least fits the pattern. Then he gave up. There was no point in telling Waxy anything. Horlocker was one of those chiefs who loved specialists, experts, and consultants. And Waxy was such a yes man that, "I'm going to need this map," Waxy said. The ghostess stared at the broad back in front of him. As he did, a light suddenly turned on inside his head. Now he knew what this was all about. He stood up. "Be my guest," he said. "The primary case files are in these cabinets here, and Sergeant Hayward has some valuable..."
"I won't be needing her," said Waxy. "Just the precinct board and the files. Have them sent over to my office by 8 tomorrow morning, room 2403. They're moving me here to headquarters."
He slowly turned on his heel and eyed DeGosta.
"Sorry, Vinny. I think it boiled down to a question of chemistry. Me and Horlocker. He needs someone he can relate to. Someone who can keep a lid on the press. Nothing personal, you know.
You'll still be on the case, in one capacity or another. And now that we're going to start making progress, you might even feel better about things. We'll be staking out the ramble, and we're going to catch this guy."
"Sure," said DeGosta.
He reminded himself that this was a no-win case, that he hadn't wanted it in the first place. It didn't help. Waxy held out his hand.
"No hard feelings, Vinny?"
DeGosta shook the plump, warm hand.
"None at all, Jack," he heard himself saying.
Waxy took another look around the office, as if searching for other items worth appropriating.
"Well, I gotta go," he said at last. "I wanted to tell you in person."
Thanks.
They stood for a moment as the uncomfortable silence grew. Then Waxy patted him awkwardly on the shoulder and walked out of the office. There was a soft rustle as Hayward came up beside him. They stood silently, listening to the footsteps retreat down the linoleum corridor until they were finally lost amidst the low buzz of typing and distant conversations. Then Hayward turned to DeGosta.
"Lieutenant, how can you let him get away with it?" she asked bitterly. "I mean, when our backs were against the wall down in those tunnels, that mother ran!"
DeGosta sat down again, feeling inside the upper drawer of his desk for a cigar.
"Respect for superiors isn't your strong suit, is it, Sergeant?" he asked. "Anyway, what makes you so sure this is a reward?"
He located the cigar, dug a hole in its crown with a pencil, and lit up. It was 2 hours later, as DeGosta was making final arrangements to move the case files upstairs, that Pendergast strolled into his office. It was Pendergast as DeGosta remembered him, impeccable black suit severely tailored to his spare frame, blonde white hair combed back from his high forehead, Gucci loafers in polished oxblood, as usual, looking more like a fashionable undertaker than an FBI agent. Pendergast indicated the visitor's chair with a brief nod of his head.
"May I?"
DeGosta hung up the phone and nodded. Pendergast slipped into the chair with his cat-like grace. He looked around, taking in the boxed files and the bare patch on the wall where the map had once hung. He turned back to DeGosta, eyebrows raised quizzically.
"It's Waxy's headache now," DeGosta answered the unspoken question. "I've been placed on modified assignment."
"Indeed," Pendergast replied. "Lieutenant, you don't seem dismayed by the turn of events."
"Dismayed?" DeGosta said. "Look around again. The precinct board's gone, the files are packed, Hayward's in bed, the coffee is hot, the cigar is lit. I feel terrific."
"I doubt it very much. Still, you'll probably sleep better tonight than Squire Waxy will. Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown, and all that."
He looked at DeGosta with an amused expression.
"So, what's next?"
"Oh, I'm still assigned to the case," DeGosta replied. "Exactly how, Waxy hasn't bothered to say."
"He probably doesn't know himself, but I think we can ensure that you won't be sitting idle."
Pendergast fell silent, and DeGosta leaned back in his chair, enjoying his cigar, content to let the silence spread out to fill the room.
"I was once in Florence," Pendergast said at last.
"Oh, yeah? I was just in Italy. Took my son there last fall to see his grandmother.
Pendergast nodded. Did you visit the Pitti Palace?
Pitti who?
It's an art museum, actually. Quiet, exquisite. There's an old medieval map painted as a fresco on one of its walls, done the year before Columbus discovered America.
No kidding.
In the place where the continent of America would later be found, the map is blank, except for the words, Cui ci sono dei mostri.
Augusta screwed up his face. Here there are... Mostri, what's that?
It means, here there be monsters.
Monsters? Yeah. Jesus, I've forgotten my Italian. I used to speak it with my grandparents.
Pendergast nodded. Lieutenant, I want you to hazard a guess at something for me.
Shoot.
Guess the largest inhabited region on Earth that remains unmapped.
The ghost shrugged. I don't know. Milwaukee?
Pendergast smiled mirthlessly. No, and it's not Outer Mongolia or the Antipodes. It's underground New York.
You're shitting me, right?
I am not shitting you, as you so charmingly put it.
Pendergast shifted in his chair.
Vincent, underground New York reminds me of that map in the Pitti Palace. It is truly unexplored territory, and it is, apparently, unimaginably vast. For example, there are almost a dozen stories worth of structures below Grand Central, not counting the sewers and storm drains. The levels below Penn Station go even deeper.
So you've been down, the ghost said.
Yes, after meeting with you and Sergeant Hayward, it was an exploratory journey, really. I wanted to get a sense of the environment, test my ability to move around and learn what I could. I was able to speak with a few of the underground dwellers. They told me much, and they hinted at even more.
The ghost sat forward. Learn anything about the murders?
Pendergast nodded. Indirectly. But those who know the most are deeper underground than I dared go on my first descent. It takes a while to gain these people's trust, and I have a long way to go, especially now. You see, the underground homeless are terrified.
Pendergast turned his pale eyes toward D'Agosta.
From piecing together various whispered conversations, I've gathered that a mysterious group of people have colonized the underground, and most of the rumors don't even use the word people. Supposedly, they are feral, cannibalistic, subhuman. And it is these beings who are responsible for the killings.
There was a pause. The ghost stood and moved to the window, gazing out at the nocturnal cityscape of Manhattan. You believe this? He asked at last.
I don't know, Pendergast replied. I need to speak to Mephisto, the leader of the community beneath Columbus Circle. Many of the things he told the Post in that recent article ring disturbingly true. Unfortunately, he's a difficult man to contact. He is distrustful of all outsiders and hates the authorities with a passion. But I feel he is the one person who can lead me where I have to go.
The ghost's lips twitched. Need a partner? He asked. A small smile appeared on Pendergast's face, then disappeared again.
It's an extremely dangerous and lawless place. However, I will consider the offer.
Fair enough? The ghost nodded.
Good. Now, I suggest you go home and get some sleep.
Pendergast rose.
Although he doesn't know it, friend Waxy is going to need all the help he can get.
21. Simon Bramble zippered up his portfolio, humming Makuchla to himself. He passed a loving glance over the lab, the safety shower in the corner, the rows of chrome and steel instruments lined up neatly behind glass, winking at him in the subdued light. He was feeling enormously pleased with himself. Once again he replayed in his head the scene of his little coup, in particular the impassive look on Frock's face as he'd been speaking. Impassive, yet
no doubt fuming inside. It made up for Frock's little sneer of triumph over the strength of the bites. Though he worked for the city government, Bramble enjoyed the one-upmanship of academia as much as anybody. He tucked the soft leather portfolio under his shoulder and once again cast his eyes about the laboratory. It was a wonderful laboratory, well-designed and well-equipped. He longed for something as elegant and comprehensive at the medical examiner's office. It would never happen, he knew. The city was chronically short of money. If he didn't find the detective work of forensic pathology so absorbing, he'd move to some well-endowed ivory tower in half a second. He closed the door behind him softly, surprised, as always, by the emptiness of the corridor. He'd never seen a bunch so averse to working late as the museum's staff. Still, he didn't mind the quiet. It was refreshing and different, just as the museum's smell of dust and old wood was so different from the stench of formalin and decay that pervaded the medical examiner's office. He decided to take the long way out of the museum, as he did every evening, through the Hall of Africa. He found the dioramas in that particular hall to be true works of art, and they looked especially good at such an advanced hour. The hall lights turned off, each diorama glowing with internal light, like a window into another world. He walked down the long corridor and, being averse to elevators, skipped down three flights of stairs. Passing beneath a metal archway, he found himself in the Hall of Ocean Life. Only the nocturnal lighting was on, and the hall looked dark and mysterious, quiet except for the ever-present clicks, groans, and creakings of the ancient fabric of the museum.
Lovely, he thought.
This was the way to see the museum, with all those horrid, shrieking children and their braying teachers absent. He passed under the replica of a giant squid, through a brace of yellowed elephant tusks, and entered the Hall of Africa. Midnight. He passed slowly through the hall, the herd of elephants at its center barely emerging from the darkness, the habitat groups arranged in a double tier around the walls on both sides of him. The gorilla group was his favorite, and he paused in front of it, pursing his lips, letting himself merge with the scene. It was so very real, and he wanted to enjoy it. Things would be wrapping up here very soon. His work was almost done. If he was right, this poor Bitterman fellow and the remains of Shasheen Walker would fall right into the pattern. At last, he turned with a sigh under a low doorway, then down a stone corridor toward the tower. He knew the story of the famous tower, how in 1870, Endurance S. Flight, railroad baron and third director of the NYMNH, had commissioned a monstrous, fortress-like addition to the original museum building. It was to be modeled after the Welsh castle of Carnarvon, which Flight had tried, unsuccessfully, to purchase for himself. Saner heads eventually prevailed, and Flight was removed from office with only the central tower of his fortress completed. Now the cornerstone of the institution's southwest facade, the six-sided tower was used primarily to store the museum's endless collections. It was also, Bramble had heard, a favorite trysting place for the more ghoulish-minded of the museum's staff. The dim, cathedral-like hall at the base of the tower was empty, and Bramble's footsteps echoed hollowly as he crossed the marble floor toward the staff exit. Nodding at the guard, he passed into the humid night air of Museum Drive. It was midnight, but the avenue beyond was still bustling with people and taxis. He took a few steps, then looked back in admiration. No matter how many times he saw it, he'd never get tired of staring at that tower. Rearing several hundred feet into the air, topped by fang-like crenellations, it threw a dark shadow as far south as 59th Street on cloudless days. Tonight, pale under the light of a waxing moon, it looked troubled, full of ghosts. At last, with a sigh, he started forward again, turned the corner onto 81st, then walked west toward the Hudson and his modest apartment, once again humming under his breath. As he went, the street gradually took on a seedier character, and the number of pedestrians began to dwindle. But Bramble took no notice, walking briskly, inhaling the night air.
There was a lovely breeze blowing in, crisp and sharp, ideal for a midsummer's night. A bite of dinner, a quick washing up, a toothful of green spot, and he'd be between the covers in an hour. As usual, he'd be up at 5 a.m., being one of those fortunate people who needed hardly any sleep. It was a great advantage to a medical examiner not to need sleep, especially one who wanted to get to the top of his profession. Bramwell couldn't begin to count the number of times he'd been the first on the scene of an important crime simply by virtue of being awake when everybody else was fast asleep. The neighborhood looked even seedier now, but it was only a block to Broadway and its bustling bagel shops, bookstores, and delis. Bramwell walked along the row of shabby brownstones, now subdivided into single-room occupancies and tiny apartments. A few harmless drunks lingered at the far corner. As he reached the center of the block, he detected movement out of the corner of his eye, something in the dark well of the basement entrance of an abandoned walk-up. He hastened his step. There was an unusually foul odor wafting from the dark entrance, pungent even for New York. Hearing something moving swiftly along the sidewalk behind him now, he instinctually reached into his portfolio for the scalpel he always carried. His mouth tightened as his fingers closed on its cold, ergonomic handle. He felt no real alarm. He'd been mugged once at gunpoint and twice at knife point, and he now knew exactly how to handle things. He drew the scalpel from the portfolio as he spun around, but there was nothing there. He looked around for a moment in surprise, before an arm slid around his neck and dragged him into the darkness. He assumed, in a surprisingly detached sort of way, that it was an arm. It had to be an arm, yet it felt slippery and so very strong. Then, almost immediately, he felt a curious digging sensation just below his Adam's apple. Yes, it was a most curious sensation, indeed. 22. Margot unlocked the door to the forensic anthropology laboratory, smugly pleased to find the room dark and empty. This was the first morning she'd managed to beat Dr. Bramwell into work. Most mornings he would be sitting on a lab stool when she arrived, sipping a cup of museum coffee and arching his narrow eyebrows over the rim at her in greeting. He would then go on to point out that the museum must percolate its coffee in second-hand formaldehyde, borrowed from the Animal Conservation Department. Other mornings she would arrive to find Frock in before her as well, the two scientists bent over a table or a report, carrying on their usual argument in polite undertones. She slung her carryall into a drawer and shrugged into her scrubs, stepping over to the window as she did so. The sun had broken over the Fifth Avenue buildings, bathing the magisterial frontage in hues of gold and copper. Below the window, the park was waking up. Mothers walking children toward the zoo, joggers trotting the long, oval course around the reservoir. Her eye moved southward, lighting at last on the purple bulk of Belvedere Castle, and she shuddered slightly as she stared into the dark, wooded area at its rear, where Nicholas Bitterman had met with violent death. His headless corpse, she knew, was due to arrive in their lab from the medical examiner's office later that morning. The door opened, and Dr. Frock wheeled himself inside, a large silhouette against the dimness of the lab. As he came forward into the sunlight, Margot turned to wish him good morning. Seeing the expression on his face, she stopped short.
"Dr. Frock?" she asked. "Are you all right?"
He came toward her slowly, the normally ruddy face drawn and pale.
"There's tragic news," he said in a low voice. "I received a call very early this morning. Simon Bramwell was murdered last night on his way home from the museum."
Margot frowned, drawing in her breath.
"Simon Bramwell?" she repeated, uncomprehending.
Frock rolled closer and took her hand.
"I'm sorry to be the one to tell you, my dear," he said. "This is all so horribly sudden."
"But how?"
Margot asked.
"It appears he was attacked on 81st Street," Frock said. "His throat was cut. Beyond that..."
Frock spread his hands, which Margot noticed were shaking with emotion. It seemed unreal, like some kind of dream. She could not believe the man who had been standing in front of that huge screen the previous afternoon, manipulating the remote pointer like a samurai sword, was now dead. Frock sighed.
Though you may not have known it, Margot, Simon and I didn't always see eye to eye. We had our professional differences. But I always had great respect for the man. It's a huge loss to the medical examiner's office, and to our work coming at this critical moment.
Our work,
echoed Margot automatically. She paused.
But who did it?
There were no witnesses. They remained motionless for a moment, Frock's hand on hers, warm and gently reassuring. Then he slowly rolled away.
I don't know who the ME's office will give us as a replacement, if anyone, he said. But I think Simon would want us to continue in the spirit in which he began.
He rolled over to the far wall and switched on the theater lights, flooding the center of the room.
I've always found work the best antidote for grief.
He was silent for a long moment. Then he sighed, as if forcing himself to continue.
Would you mind removing cadaver A from the refrigerator? I have a theory about a potential genetic anomaly that might have caused this deformity. Unless you would like the day off?
He raised his eyebrows.
No,
Margot said, shaking her head. Frock was right. Brambell would want them to continue. Standing slowly and walking across the room, she knelt, opened a cabinet door, and pulled out the long metal tray inside. The unidentified body which lay on it had been reduced and rearranged to a mere series of irregular lumps under the blue sheet. She slid it onto a stretcher and rolled it under the lights. Frock carefully pulled off the sheet and began the painstaking process of measuring the carpal bones of the deformed skeleton with a pair of electronic calipers. Feeling an eerie sense of unreality, Margot went back to examining yet another series of MRI scans. The lab fell into a long silence.
"Do you have any idea what lead Simon was referring to yesterday?" Frock asked at last.
"I'm sorry,"
Margot said, looking up.
"No, I don't. He never discussed it with me. I was as surprised as you were."
"A shame," said Frock. "As far as I know, he left no notes about it either."
He fell silent again for some time.
"This is a real setback, Margot," he said at last in a quiet voice. "We may never learn what it is he discovered."
"Nobody ever makes their plans as if they're going to die the next day."
Frock shook his head.
"Simon was like most of the MEs I've known. Exciting, high-profile cases like this are rare, and when one comes along, well, they can't always resist the drama."
He looked suddenly at his watch.
"Oh, dear. You know, I almost forgot that I have an appointment in osteology. Margot, I wonder if you would be willing to leave that aside and take over here for a while. Maybe it's this tragic news, or maybe I've just been staring at these bones too long. But I think the work could benefit from a fresh eye."
"Of course,"
said Margot.
"What exactly are you looking for?"
"I wish I knew. I'm quite sure this person had a congenital disease. I want to quantify the morphological changes to see if there's been a genetic shift. Unfortunately, that means measuring almost every bone in the body. I thought I'd start with the wrist and finger bones, since, as you know, they're the most sensitive to genetic change."
Margot looked down at the examining table.
"That could take days," she said.
Frock shrugged in exasperation.
"I'm only too aware of that, my dear."
He gripped the rails of his wheelchair and gave himself a powerful push toward the door. Wearily, Margot began measuring each bone with the electronic calipers and entering the measurements on the workstation keyboard. Even the smallest bones required a dozen measurements, and soon a long column of numbers was scrolling up the nearby screen. She tried not to grow impatient with the tedious work and the tomb-like silence of the lab. If Frock was right, and the deformation was congenital, this would greatly narrow their search for the identity of the body. And at this point, they could use any lead they could find. The skeletons from the physical anthropology lab had provided no clues. As she worked, she found herself wondering what Brambell would have thought. but the memory of Bramble was too awful to think of the man set upon and murdered. She shook her head, forcing herself to concentrate on other things. The sudden ringing of the telephone jarred her from a particularly complicated measurement. It rang again, two short beeps, and she realized it was an outside call, probably DeGosta calling about Dr. Bramble. She picked it up.
Forensics.
Is Dr. Bramble there?
Asked a clipped, youthful-sounding voice.
Dr. Bramble?
Margot's thoughts raced. What if it was a relative? What should she say?
Hello?
Came the voice.
Yes, yes, said Margot. Dr. Bramble isn't available. Can I help you?
I'm not sure. It's a confidential matter. May I ask who I'm speaking to?
The name is Dr. Green, said Margot. I'm assisting him.
Ah, that's fine, then. This is Dr. Cavalieri from St. Luke's in Baltimore. I've identified that patient he's looking for.
Patient?
Yes, the one with the spondylolisthesis.
Margot could hear the shuffling of paper on the other end of the line.
This is one bizarre set of x-rays you sent me. At first I thought there was some kind of joke. I almost missed it.
Margot fumbled for a pad of paper and a pencil.
You'd better start from the beginning.
Fine,
came the voice.
I'm an orthopedic surgeon down in Baltimore. There are only three of us here who do corrective surgery to reduce a spondylolisthesis. Dr. Bramble knew that, of course.
Spondylolisthesis. There was a silence.
You're not a physician?
Cavalieri asked, his tone suddenly disapproving. Margot took a deep breath.
Dr. Cavalieri, I might as well tell you, Dr. Bramble was... Well, he died last night. I'm an evolutionary biologist helping him analyze the remains of several homicide victims. Since Dr. Bramble is no longer here, I'll need you to tell me everything.
Died? Why, I just spoke to him yesterday.
It was very sudden, said Margot. She did not want to go into any more detail.
But that's terrible. Dr. Bramble was well known across the country, not to mention the United Kingdom.
The voice petered out. Margot, holding the silent phone to her ear, thought again about the last time she'd seen the medical examiner. At the front of Linnaeus Hall, smiling deviously, eyes flashing behind the horn rims. She was roused by a sigh on the other end of the line.
A spondylolisthesis is a fracture and slippage of one of the lumbar vertebrae. We correct it by fixing a metal plate to the spine with pedicle lag screws. As you tighten the screws to the plate, it draws the fractured vertebrae back into place.
I'm not sure I see the connection, Margot said.
You remember those four white triangles on the x-rays you sent me? Those are the lags for the plate screws. This fellow had an operation for spondylolisthesis. Very few surgeons do the procedure, which makes it easy to trace.
I see, said Margot.
I know that this x-ray is from a patient of mine for one very good reason,
Cavalieri continued.
It's clear that these particular lag bolts were manufactured by SteelMed Products of Minneapolis, which went out of business in 1989. I performed about 36 operations using SteelMed lag screws. I used a special technique of my own, a particular placement of the screws behind the transverse process of the second lumbar. A rather brilliant technique, actually. You can read about it in the fall 1987 issue of the Journal of American Orthopedics if you're interested. It held the bone better, you see, and required less bone fusion. No one else performed it but myself and two residents I instructed. Of course, it was considered obsolete after the Steinman procedure was developed. So in the end, I was the only doctor who used it.
Margot could hear the pride in the doctor's voice.
But here's the mystery. No surgeon that I ever knew would remove the corrective plate for this kind of spondylolisthesis. It simply isn't done. Yet these x-rays clearly show that my patient had the metal plate and screws removed, God knows why, leaving only the lags behind. You can't remove the lags, of course. They're set into the bone. But why this fellow had the plates removed?
His voice trailed off. Margot scribbled notes furiously.
Go on.
As I said, when I saw the x-rays, I knew immediately that this was one of my patients. However, I was astonished at the condition of the skeleton. That riot of bone growth. I knew I'd never operated on anyone with a condition like that.
So the bone growth occurred afterwards?
Absolutely. In any case, I went back to my records, and based on the X-ray evidence, I was able to identify the patient. I operated on him the morning of October 2nd, 1988.
And who was the patient? Margot asked, pencil at the ready. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw that Frock had re-entered the lab and was rolling toward her, listening intently.
It's right here somewhere.
She could hear another rustling of papers.
I'll fax all these records to you, of course, but I'm sure you'll still... Here we are. The patient was named Gregory S. Kawakita.
Margot felt her blood freeze.
Greg Kawakita? She croaked.
Yes, Gregory S. Kawakita, Ph.D. No question about it. Funny. Says here that he was an evolutionary biologist, too. Maybe you knew him?
Margot hung up the telephone, unable to speak. First, Dr. Bramwell, and now... She glanced at Frock, alarmed to see that his face had grown ashen. He was slumped to one side of the wheelchair, a hand pressed hard to his chest, his breathing labored.
Gregory? Kawakita? Frock breathed. This is Gregory. Oh, my good Lord.
His breathing eased, and he shut his eyes and slowly hung his head. Margot turned quickly and ran to the window, choking back sobs. Of its own accord, her mind flashed back to that horrible week 18 months before, when the murders started at the museum. Then, the opening of the superstition exhibition, the mass slaughter, and the final killing of the Mbun. Greg Kawakita had been an assistant curator at the museum, a colleague of hers, a student of Frock's. More than almost anyone else, Greg had helped identify and stop the monster. It had been his genetic extrapolation program that provided the key, that told them what Mbun was and how it could be killed. But the horror that followed had affected everyone, especially Greg. He'd left the museum soon after, abandoning a brilliant career. No one had heard from him since. No one except her. He'd tried to reach her, leaving a message on her answering machine several months before. At the time, he said he'd needed something, needed her help. She hadn't even bothered to respond. And now she could guess why he must have left the museum. He'd been suffering some dreadful disease that was deforming his bones, turning him slowly into that twisted skeleton on the gurney. No doubt he was ashamed, probably afraid. Perhaps he had tried to seek treatment. Maybe toward the end he had become homeless. And then, the ultimate insult to a life once so full of promise, murder, decapitation, the frenzied gnawing of bones in the dark. She stared out the window, shuddering in the warm sun. Whatever end he had suffered, it must have been horrible. Perhaps she could have helped him, had she known. But she'd been too wrapped up in trying to forget it all herself, losing herself in her workouts and her work. And she'd done nothing. Dr. Frock? She called out. She heard the rumbling of the wheelchair behind her.
Dr. Frock?
She whispered, unable to continue. She felt a gentle hand touch her elbow. It was trembling with emotion.
Let me think for a moment, Frock said. Just for a moment, please. How could this be? To think this pathetic collection of bones that we've studied, picked at, disassembled, could be Gregory.
His voice broke. A beam of light shone through the window and highlighted the hand as it slipped from her elbow. Margot stood motionless, closing her eyes now against the light, feeling the oxygen stream in and out of her lungs. Eventually, she felt able to turn away from the window, but not toward the examining table. She wasn't sure she would ever be able to face the contents of that table again. Instead, she turned toward Frock. He was there behind her, motionless, his eyes dry and far away.
"We'd better call DeGosta," she said.
For a long time, Frock did not speak. Then, silently, he nodded his assent.
Qui ci sono dei mostri? Part 2.
For obvious reasons, No reliable census of Manhattan's underground population exists. However, the Rushing Bunton study of 1994 indicates that 2,750 persons live in just the small area bordered by Penn Station on the southwest and Grand Central Terminal on the northeast, with the population rising to 4,500 during the winter months. In this writer's experience, such a number seems conservative. Similarly, there is no accurate record of the births and deaths that take place in the communities beneath New York. However, given the disproportionate number of drug abusers, criminals, ex-convicts, mentally handicapped, and mentally unstable people who gravitate to the world below the surface, it is clear that the environment can be an extremely difficult and dangerous one. People have given many reasons for retreating from society into the darkness of the railroad tunnels and other subterranean spaces. Privacy, security, a deep alienation from society. It has been estimated that once a person goes underground, the average life expectancy is approximately 22 months. L. Hayward, Caste and Society Beneath Manhattan, forthcoming. 23. West 63rd Street stretched toward the Hudson, the procession of magnificent co-ops yielding gradually to manicured brownstones. DeGosto walked resolutely, keeping his eyes down, feeling acutely self-conscious. The shabby, fragrant form of Pendergast shuffled along just in front of him.
"Hell of a way to spend my afternoon off," DeGosto muttered.
Though he found himself itching in many remote places, he decided not to scratch. Scratching meant touching the ancient, greasy London fog raincoat he wore, or the filthy Kmart plaid polyester shirt, or the shiny, threadbare trousers. He wondered where Pendergast had gotten all this stuff. On top of all that, the dirt and grease on his face were real, not something out of a makeup tin. Even his shoes were disgusting. But when he'd balked, Pendergast had said simply,
"Vincent, your life depends on it."
He hadn't even been allowed to carry his gun or shield.
"You don't want to know," Pendergast had said, "what they'll do to you if they find a badge."
In fact, DeGosta thought morosely, this whole expedition was a direct violation of departmental regulations. Glancing up briefly, he spotted a woman approaching, spotless in a crisp summer dress and high heels, walking a chihuahua. She stopped abruptly, stepping to one side and averting her eyes with a distasteful look. As Pendergast passed by, the dog suddenly lunged forward, erupting with a shrill volley of squeaky barks. Pendergast shuffled aside, and the dog redoubled its hysterical efforts, tugging against the leash. Despite his discomfort, or perhaps because of it, DeGosta found himself growing annoyed at the look of loathing on the woman's face.
"Who the hell is she to judge us?" he thought.
As he was passing, he suddenly stopped and turned to face her.
"Have a nice day," he growled, thrusting his chin forward.
The woman shrank backwards.
"You revolting man!" she shrieked at DeGosta. "Stay away from him, petty chow!"
Pendergast grabbed DeGosta and pulled him around the corner onto Columbus Avenue.
"Are you mad?"
he said under his breath. As they hurried on, DeGosta could hear the woman calling.
"Help! Those men threatened me!"
Pendergast dashed southward, DeGosta struggling to keep up. Moving into the shadow of a large driveway halfway down the block, Pendergast knelt quickly above the steel plate set into the sidewalk that marked an emergency subway exit. Using a small, hooked tool, he levered up the plates, then ushered DeGosta down the iron stairs beneath. Closing them behind him, Pendergast followed DeGosta into the darkness. At the bottom were two sets of train tracks, dimly illuminated. Crossing the tracks, they reached an archway leading to another descending set of stairs, which they took two steps at a time. On the lowest step, Pendergast stopped. DeGosta stopped beside him in the pitch blackness, fighting for breath. After a few moments, Pendergast switched on a penlight, chuckling.
"Have a nice day. Vincent, what could you have been thinking?" "Just trying to be friendly," DeGosta said truculently. "You could have sunk our little expedition before it left the dock.
Remember, you're here simply to complete my disguise. The only way I'm certain to see Mephisto is if I pose as the leader of another community, and I'd never travel without an aide-de-camp.
He gestured with his penlight into a narrow side tunnel. That way leads east into his territory. The Ghost nodded. Remember my instructions. I'll do the talking. It's imperative that you forget you're a police officer. No matter what happens, don't try to interfere.
He reached into the pocket of his grimy trench coat, bringing out two floppy woolen hats.
Put this on, he said, handing one to DaGosta.
Why?
Headgear disguises the true contours of a person's head. Besides, if we're forced to make a quick escape, we can break our profiles by discarding them. Remember, we're not used to the darkness. We'll be the ones at a disadvantage.
He dug into the pocket again and took out a small, dull object which he fitted into his mouth.
What the hell is that? The Ghost asked, pulling the hat onto his head.
A false rubber pellet for changing tongue position, thus modifying the harmonic resonances of the throat. We will be consorting with criminals, remember? I spent a fair amount of time last year at Rikers Island profiling murderers for Quantico. It's possible that I'll come in contact with some of them down here. If so, they must not recognize me, either by appearance or voice.
He waved his hand.
Of course, makeup alone isn't enough. I must adapt my posture, way of walking, even mannerisms. Your job is easier. Keep silent, blend in, follow my lead. We must not in any way stand out, understood?
The Ghost nodded.
With any luck, this Mephisto will be able to point us in the right direction. Perhaps we'll return with evidence of the killings he described at the post. That could provide additional forensics material we desperately need.
He paused.
Any leads on the Bramble murder?
He asked. He took a step forward, shining the penlight ahead.
No, said the Ghost. Waxy and the top brass think it was just another random killing. But I'm wondering if it didn't have something to do with his work.
Pendergast nodded.
An interesting theory.
Seems to me that these killings, or at least some of them, aren't random at all. I mean, Bramble was on the verge of discovering who the second skeleton belonged to. Maybe somebody didn't want that known.
Pendergast nodded again.
I have to admit, Lieutenant, I was flabbergasted when I heard the second skeleton belonged to Kawakita. It opens up a vista of...
He paused.
Complexity and ugliness. And it suggests that Dr. Frock, Dr. Green, and the others working on the case should be protected.
The Ghost scowled. I went up to Horlocker's office this morning with that in mind. He dismissed any kind of protection for Green or Frock. Said he suspected Kawakita must have been involved with Pamela Wisher somehow, just got caught in the wrong place in the wrong time. A random killing, like Bramble. All he cared was that we didn't leak anything about it to the press, at least until Kawakita's family is tracked down and alerted, assuming there's any left to alert. I think somebody once said he was an orphan. Waxy was there, too, strutting and preening like an overstuffed rooster. He told me to do a better job of keeping this under wraps than I did with Wisher.
And?
I suggested he go put a poultice on it. Politely, of course. I'd been thinking it was best not to alarm Frock or Green. But after that meeting, I talked to them both, gave them some advice. They promised to be very careful, at least until their work is finished.
Have they discovered what caused the skeletal deformation in Kawakita?
Not yet,
the Ghost nodded absently. Pendergast turned toward him.
What is it?
He asked. The Ghost hesitated.
I suppose I'm a little worried about how Dr. Green is taking all this. I mean, it was my idea to tap her and Frock in the first place, but now I'm not so sure. Frock seems to be his usual ornery self, but Margot...
He paused.
You know how she reacted to the museum murders? Conditioning herself, running every day, packing a pistol?
Pendergast nodded.
It's not an uncommon type of post-traumatic stress reaction. People who emerge from terrifying situations sometimes look for ways to gain control, to limit their feelings of vulnerability.
Actually, it's a relatively healthy response to severe stress.
He smiled grimly.
And I can think of few more stressful situations than the one she and I found ourselves in, there in that darkened museum corridor.
Yeah, but she's overdoing it. And now, with all this shit happening, well, I'm not sure I made the right decision, calling her in like I did.
It was absolutely the right decision. We need her expertise, especially now that we know Kawakita is dead. You'll be investigating his last known whereabouts, I trust?
DaGosta nodded.
You might consider asking Dr. Green to lend a hand with that.
Pendergast resumed his scrutiny of the tunnel, peering into the darkness with his sooty face.
Oh, well. Ready, Vincent?
I guess so.
What if we meet hostiles?
Pendergast smiled slightly.
Trading in local commerce tends to keep the natives peaceful.
Drugs?
DaGosta asked in disbelief. Pendergast nodded, opening his coat. In the gleam of the penlight, DaGosta could make out several tiny pockets stitched into the filthy lining.
It appears that virtually everyone down here is or has been an addict of one kind or another.
His finger moved from one pocket to the next.
I have an entire pharmacopoeia here. Crack cocaine, methylphenidate, carbitol, sicanol, military-grade blue 88s. They may well save our lives, Vincent. They saved mine on my first descent.
Pendergast dug into one of the small pockets and pulled out a slender, black capsule.
Biphetamine, he said, known in the underground fraternity as a black beauty.
He stared at the capsule for a moment. Then, with a quick movement, he popped it into his mouth.
What the—
DaGosta began, but the FBI agent held his hand out for silence.
It's not enough for me to act the part, Pendergast whispered. I have to be the part.
This Mephisto is undoubtedly a suspicious, paranoid individual. Scenting fraud is his stock in trade. Remember that. DaGosta said nothing. They really had stepped outside society, outside the law, outside everything. They passed into the side tunnel and moved along an abandoned rail line. Every few minutes, Pendergast would stop to consult some notes. Following the FBI agent deeper into darkness, DaGosta was amazed at how quickly he lost his own orientation, his sense of time. Suddenly, Pendergast pointed toward a wavering, reddish light, seemingly suspended in the darkness perhaps 100 yards ahead of them.
There are people around that fire, he whispered. It's probably a small upstairs community, squatters living at the edge of Mephisto's domain.
He stared speculatively at the glow for a few moments. Then he turned.
Shall we retire to the drawing room?
He asked, and without waiting for an answer began moving toward the distant glow. As they drew closer, DaGosta made out a dozen or so figures lounging on the ground or hunched atop milk crates, staring into the fire. A bubbling, black coffee pot sat among the coals. Pendergast ambled into the firelight and squatted down beside the blaze. Nobody paid any attention. He reached into one of the many layers of his outfit and pulled out a pint bottle of English Lord Deluxe Tokay wine. DaGosta watched as all eyes swiveled in the direction of the bottle. Pendergast unscrewed the cap and took a long pull, sighing contentedly.
Anybody want a slug?
He asked, turning the bottle's label toward the firelight so all could see. DaGosta was momentarily taken aback. The FBI agent's voice had changed utterly. It now sounded thick, drugged, with a distinct Flatbush accent. Pendergast's pale skin, eyes, and hair looked alien and menacing in the flickering glare. A hand reached out.
Here,
came a voice. A man on a milk crate took the bottle and placed it to his lips. There was a long, sucking noise. When he handed it back to Pendergast, a quarter of the contents were gone. Pendergast passed the bottle to another, and it went around the circle, returning empty. There was a single grunt of thanks. DaGosta tried to maneuver into the plume of smoke, hoping to dilute the stench of unwashed human bodies, bad wine, and rancid urine.
I'm looking for Mephisto, Pendergast said after a moment.
There was a momentary stir around the campfire. The men seemed suddenly wary.
Who wants to know?
The one who'd first taken the bottle asked belligerently.
I want to know,
said Pendergast, immediately belligerent himself. There was a short silence while the man eyed Pendergast, sizing him up.
Up yours, Jack,
he said at last, sinking back into his chair. Pendergast moved so quickly that the ghost had jumped away, startled. When he looked back, the man was face down in the rubble and Pendergast was standing over him, one foot planted on his neck.
Shit!
The man howled. Pendergast pressed down.
Nobody this is Whitey,
he hissed.
It didn't mean nothing, man. Jesus!
Pendergast eased up slightly.
Mephisto hangs out at the Route 666. Where's that?
Stop it, man! That shit hurts! Look, head down track 100. Watch for the old generator. Take the ladder down to the catwalk.
Pendergast released his foot, and the man sat up, rubbing his neck.
Mephisto don't like outsiders.
Him and I have business to discuss.
Yeah?
About what?
About the wrinklers.
Even in the dark, the ghost sensed the group stiffen.
What about them?
A new voice asked sharply.
I thought for Mephisto only.
Pendergast nodded to DeGosta, and they moved away from the campfire, continuing on into the darkness of the tunnel. When the fire had receded to a dwindling point, Pendergast once again snapped on the penlight.
You can't let anyone disrespect you down here,
Pendergast said quietly. Even a marginal group like that, if they sense weakness, you're as good as dead.
Those were some pretty slick moves, DeGosta said.
It's not difficult to knock down a drunk. On my last trip down, I learned that alcohol is the drug of choice on these upper levels. Except for that one thin fellow farthest from the fire, I'd wager, Lieutenant, that he was a skin popper.
Did you notice how he was absently scratching himself during the entire meeting? The side effect of fentanyl, quite unmistakable.
The tunnel branched, and after consulting a rail yard map from one of his pockets, Pendergast took the narrower, left-hand passage.
This leads to track 100. He said.
DeGosta shuffled on behind. After what seemed an interminable distance, Pendergast stopped again, pointing out a great, rusting machine with several huge belt gears, each at least 12 feet in diameter. The rotted belt lay underneath in a heap on the ground. On the far side was a metal staircase, ending at a catwalk suspended above an ancient tunnel. Ducking under a stalactite-covered pipe stenciled H.P. Street, DeGosta followed Pendergast down the staircase and along the rickety grating. At the end of the catwalk, a hinged plate in the floor led to a metal ladder, which descended into a large, unfinished tunnel. Rock and rusted metal I-beams lay in untidy piles against the walls. Although DeGosta could see the remains of several camps, the place appeared deserted.
"We have to climb down this rock, it seems,"
said Pendergast, shining the penlight beam into a large area at the end of the tunnel. The edges of the rock were slick with the impressions of countless hands and feet. A caustic smell drifted up. DeGosta went first, clinging desperately to the sharp, wet basalt. It was the work of 5 terrifying minutes to reach the bottom. He felt like he was entombed in the very bedrock of the island.
"I'd like to see someone climb that thing messed up on drugs," he said, as Pendergast dropped to the ground beside him.
The muscles in his arms were shaking from the exertion.
"Below here, nobody leaves," said Pendergast,
"except the runners."
"Runners?"
"As I understand it, they are the only community members who have contact with the surface. They collect and cash AFDC checks, rummage for food, bust recyclables for spare change, pick up medicine and milk, buy drugs." Pendergast shone his light around, revealing a rough, rocky pit. On the far wall, a 5-foot piece of corrugated tin covered an abandoned tunnel. A crude message painted on the wall beside it read, "Families only. All others keep out." Pendergast grabbed the sheet of metal and it swung open with a loud screech.
"Doorbell," he explained.
As they stepped into the tunnel, a ragged-looking figure suddenly appeared in front of them, a large firebrand in one hand. He was tall, and terrifyingly gaunt.
"Who are you?"
he demanded, standing in Pendergast's way.
"Are you Tail Gunner?"
Pendergast asked.
"Outside,"
the man said, pushing them toward the tin door. In a moment they were back out in the rocky pit. "The name's Flint. What do you want?"
"I'm here to see Mephisto,"
Pendergast replied.
"What for?"
"I'm the leader of Grant's Tomb, a small community beneath Columbia University. I've come to talk about the killings."
There was a long silence.
"And him?"
Flint said, gesturing at the Ghosta.
"My runner," said Pendergast.
Flint turned back to Pendergast.
"Weapons or drugs?"
he asked.
"No weapons," said Pendergast.
In the lambent glow of a firebrand, he looked suddenly embarrassed.
"But I do carry my own little supply."
"No drugs here," said Flint. "We're a clean community."
"Bullshit,"
the Ghosta thought, looking into the man's burning eyes.
"Sorry," said Pendergast. "I don't give up my stash, if that's a problem."
"What have you got?" Flint asked.
"Money or business?"
"Coke?" he asked, and DeGosta thought he detected a faint, hopeful tone in his voice.
"Good guess," said Pendergast after a moment.
"I'm going to have to confiscate that."
"Consider it a gift."
Pendergast brought out a small, folded piece of tinfoil and handed it to Flint, who quickly tucked it into his coat.
"Follow me,"
he said. DeGosta pulled the metal sheet closed behind them and followed Flint as he led them down a metal staircase. The staircase ended in a narrow opening that led onto a cement landing, suspended far above a vast, cylindrical room. Flint turned and began moving down a cement ramp that spiraled along the wall. As he walked down the ramp, DeGosta noticed that several cubbyholes had been cut into the rock. Each cubbyhole was occupied by individuals or families. Candles and kerosene lamps flickered over dirty faces and filthy beddings. Looking across the vast space, DeGosta could see a broken pipe jutting from the wall. Water spilled from the pipe and fell into a muddy pool that had been excavated out of the cavern floor. Several figures huddled around it, apparently washing clothes. The dirty water ran away in a stream and disappeared into the broken mouth of a tunnel. Reaching the bottom, they crossed the stream on an ancient board. Groups of underground dwellers dotted the cavern floor, sleeping or playing cards. A man lay in a far corner, his eyes open and milky, and DeGosta realized he was awaiting burial. He turned away. Flint led them through a long, low passage from which many tunnels seemed to branch. In the dim light at the end of some of the corridors, DeGosta could see people at work, storing canned goods, mending clothes, distilling grain alcohol. At last, Flint brought them out into a space filled with the glow of electric light. Looking up, DeGosta saw a single light bulb dangling from a frayed cord that ran to an old junction box in one corner. DeGosta's eyes traveled down from the bulb along the crack-riddled bricks that lined the chamber. Then he froze, a gasp of disbelief on his lips. In the center of the room was a battered and ancient train caboose, tilted at a crazy angle, its rear wheels suspended at least 2 feet above the floor. How it had ended up in this strange, lunatic place he couldn't begin to imagine. Along its side, he barely could make out the letters New Yo Centra in faded black on the rusted red metal. Motioning them to stay put, Flint entered the caboose. He emerged a few minutes later, beckoning them forward. Stepping inside, DeGosta found himself in a small antechamber, the far end of which was covered with a thick, dark curtain. Flint had vanished. The caboose was dark and stupefyingly hot.
"Yes,"
hissed a strange voice from beyond the curtain. Pendergast cleared his throat.
"I'm known as Whitey, leader of Grant's Tomb. We heard about your call for the underground people to band together to stop the killings."
There was a silence. DeGosta wondered what lay beyond the curtain.
Maybe nothing. Maybe it's like in The Wizard of Oz. Maybe Smithback had just made half the article up. You could never tell with journalists.